Talk given Friday, 16th January 1981. Karma is misrepresented as retributive justice. Note carefully the whole phrase. Retributive justice. Just as in Greek mythology, we have Nemesis as the goddess of retributive justice. And we have the English phrase, Nemesis will catch up with you sometime or other for your misdeeds. There's another misrepresentation. Karma is regarded as similar to a process of equilibration. And this is probably partly due, maybe considerably due, to the influence of the knowledge of Newton's third law of motion, that action and reaction are equal and opposite. Now, carefully note exactly what the law is, that action and reaction are equal and they are opposite. And karma is also misrepresented as a rigid law of causation. And this is specifically concerned with the Buddhist presentation and the Buddhist world. Now, there is a grain of truth, but only a very small grain of truth, in the above concepts. Because the grain of truth is just this. There is a relationship between an action now, and by action I mean not only a physical action, but an action in thought and word. There is a relationship between an action now and a subsequent appearance or phenomenon sometime later on. That time may be short or it may be very long. In the Buddha's own teaching, what he said was, that being, this becomes. By that he meant such and such a set of circumstances or forces are at work, and as a consequence, what you see now here, this is what has become as a result of those forces at work. Now, let us consider this a little seriously. For example, a man and wife conjugate on 1st January. A baby arrives on 7th October, 280 days. Now, people will say, oh, that was the man and woman's karma, the consequence of their action. They put it in such simple terms, altogether simplistic terms. And then they ask, sometimes a person might ask, now whose karma was it? Was it the man's karma, the woman's karma, or the baby's karma? What people do not take into account or consider at all is that between the 1st of January and the 7th of October, 10,000 factors, influences, people, events have all interplayed with all three people concerned, the man and his wife and the embryo baby, and the final result is the birth of this child. Now that is not taken into account. And so they ask, whose karma is it? Now the question obviously is wrongly worded. It is worded as if karma was somebody's property or quality or something, that it belongs to somebody. This is quite a mistaken viewpoint. Karma is not a simple 1 + 1 = 2 affair. It is an involved process of unimaginable complexity, in which two people, the man and his wife, and when the time arrived, the third person was involved. But actually, the third person was involved from the beginning, from the moment of conception onwards. You see? So, if we just consider any other situation, we will find that in every single situation, there is an unimaginable complexity. So many thousands of factors have played their part. Influences have played their part. So we must observe and understand karma as process, and further, not as particular process in a particular situation only, because every particular process and every particular situation, as we call it and regard it, is completely involved with the totality of the universe. Modern science has definitely agreed with that now at last. That if you want to understand any one event properly, you'd have to understand every other single event in the universal process. The universe functions as a whole, as a totality. And you cannot get complete understanding of any one thing without getting full understanding of all the interrelationships, all the interactions with every other thing too. So, observe and understand karma as universal process in which you and I are personally involved, and not as my karma or your karma. We cannot exercise the possessive pronoun in relationship to karma. Now let us consider this common conception of retributive justice. You know how often we've heard even eminent lecturers on the platform said, "You did this in such and such a life, and therefore in this life you are enjoying these rewards or undergoing these miseries." Now, this phrase, retributive justice, is a self-contradictory phrase. It is as meaningless as saying that God is a separate entity, a personal being, and is immortal and eternal, infinite, and so on. No entity can possibly be associated with the reality of infinity or eternity or immortality. It's totally impossible, utterly illogical. Now, retribution or punishment is of the nature of vengeance. If it is not a revenge action, it is something cruel, a deliberate infliction of pain or sorrow or whatever it is upon someone. Whether it be by the law or by an irate school teacher or parent or whatever it is. There's the deliberate infliction of pain. Therefore, retribution is rooted in hate. It is very intimately associated with fear, with violence, and it itself is an example of unskill in action. Unskill in action. Now, I mention this particularly for the benefit of those who are either interested in and or practicing yoga. You remember how Sri Krishna in the Gita says, Arjuna, yoga is skill in action. There's a very deep and profound meaning to it all. I won't go into it, otherwise we'll eat up too much time. But this retribution, punishment, is an example of unskill in action. It does not, therefore, conduce to progressive change. The change it brings about is a state of reaction in which the feeling of getting one's own back, of revenge and so forth, is stored up in the subconscious. And someday, when the circumstance is sufficiently provocative and conducive, it will burst out in a worse manner than the ordinary sort of pain or difficulty which one experiences. It is not conducive to growth which culminates in true flowering, in true fulfillment. Punishment belongs to and confines us to the context of the finite, of sorrow, of decay and mortality. It confines us to bondage and evil. That is what retribution or punishment does. Put it in another form, retribution does not heal. It does not make whole. It is not holy. It's unholy. It is not, obviously, creative action. Karma is creative action. We have, during the last few years, again and again, considered this point about karma being creative action in eternity. That is its fundamental meaning, from kri to create. Now, justice heals, if it is true justice, which is completely different from retribution or punishment and effects of retribution. Justice heals, for it holds within itself mercy and compassion, patience and forbearance, and deep understanding and wisdom. Justice holds all these things in itself. You know how, for example, in the Kabbalistic presentation of the tree of life in the shape of a human being, the Tiferet, the center there at the heart, holds the balance between Hesed, absolute mercy, which would lead to chaos, then there'd be no cohesive force to preserve order, on the one hand, and gevura, or punishment, on the other hand. Tiferet holds the balance, and Tiferet represents so many wonderful things. Represents beauty. I mention beauty because you'll hear later on something else in connection with this. Beauty, justice, and so on. Now, since it holds all these qualities with it, it is rooted in the infinite and immortal. For in arriving at its judgments, it is sensitive to many of the elements which compose the karmic process. Justice involves judgment, of course, and in arriving at those judgments, it is sensitive to many of the elements which compose the karmic process. And the karmic process is a process of creative activity, actually. That's what it is. And it has a vision of the relationship of these elements to the creative activity of karma. That is why it is rooted in the context of the transcendent. When theologists present the idea of God as an absolutely just God, they also mention mercy and compassion. You get it in Islam, the merciful and the all-compassionate Allah. But if you see some of the other aspects of Allah, you will start questioning where is the mercy and the compassion. In the Old Testament, this zealous God of the Hebrews, he's not a jealous God in our sense of the word jealousy. He's zealous. He's concerned for the welfare of his people, Israel. You see? And he's zealous for their... He has zeal, complete zeal for them. That is what that thing means. And the zealous God is full of mercy and compassion. And you get mercy and compassion mentioned again and again in the Old Testament. Now, this, therefore, is a power which persuasively moves all things towards their true fulfillment. Thus we see that retributive justice is a self-contradictory phrase quite misrepresenting karma. You might ask, but we do experience pain and suffering due to our mistakes, our deliberate wrongdoing, or wrongdoing through ignorance or some unfortunate situation or whatever it is. What about that? Well, of course, the pain element does come in, always. Even in acts which are compassionate acts, the pain element comes in. Take, for example, illness, and the doctor, or whoever it is, healing that, soothing the pain and so forth, and assuaging him. In that act, in the process of compassion, he may have to administer some medicine, or he may have to perform an operation, which is a painful thing. So the pain element is also present. We mustn't judge everything from the purely from the pleasure pain standpoint. Pain has to be endured even by the perfect Holy One. Pain is endured by God Himself. Not pain in our physical sense of the word pain. But think of the sacrifice which has to be made when transcendence expresses manifestation. Out of the state of absolute bliss, something is pressed out of that state of bliss in order to manifest something in the cosmos. If I do evil, it is not I who am going to be reborn and suffer in another life. But the effect of that evil done compels transcendence to express a bit of itself back again into the world of pain and misery and so forth. If you look at it that way, you get quite a different slant upon it. Quite a different understanding. Now the great teachers, the perfected holy ones, knew this all too well. Let us see what they taught. This is the Gospel of St. Matthew, chapter 5, from verse 39 to 38. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. Ye have heard, but I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, in order that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. Now, that completely wipes out any such thing as retributive justice, which, as we see clearly, is a self-contradictory phrase. And it wipes out the infliction of punishment. You see, punishment in the sense of deliberately inflicted pain or difficulty or deprivation as the consequence of some particular action or whatever it may be. I know there'll be lots of questions which arise with regard to worldly affairs in this matter. Now, let us look at what the Buddha says. This is a discourse called the Parable of the Saw. There are, monks, five ways of speaking in which others, when speaking to you, might speak, at a right time or at a wrong time, according to fact or not according to fact, gently or harshly, on what is connected with the goal or on what is not connected with the goal, with a mind of friendliness or full of hatred. Five ways in which people might speak to you. And then the Buddha later on goes on to say, herein, monks, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell, with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred, and we will dwell, having suffused that person with a mind of friendliness. Now this is something terrific. Suffuse the person who speaks harshly or unkindly to you, you see. Suffuse him with a mind of friendliness, and beginning with him, we will dwell, having suffused the whole world with a mind like the earth, far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. That is how you must train yourselves, monks, says the Buddha. And then he goes on and gives the sort of peak point of this attitude. He says, monks, even if low-down thieves might carve you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, yet even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity, he, for this reason, is not a doer of my teaching. Herein, monks, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred. And, beginning with him, we will dwell, having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. This is how you must train yourselves, monks. Now you see the extraordinary situation. In the worldly context of the finite, the temporal and the mortal, evil gets done. Evil takes place. But what is the response to that? From the world of transcendence, the infinite, the eternal and the immortal, the supreme qualities, the supreme spiritual values must be exemplified in the way we respond within our minds. You see, this is extraordinary, isn't it? Because the one simple reason why such a teaching is given is that if and when one can do so, then one has manifested the truth of the fact that transcendence is embodied in us. And as I have said 100 times, transcendence never compels. It just waits with infinite patience, waits through all time until you yourself see that and will respond transcendentally of your own free will and accord. Now, obviously, this is all very, very difficult. And people will naturally say, oh my goodness, that's just beyond me, I can't do it, I haven't got the capacity. Yes, it is good to acknowledge what we cannot do and to know our shortcomings. But it is bad to say that therefore I shall sit tight and do nothing about it. Because what is our potentiality must of necessity come out. And if we keep on in our life, throughout our life, deliberately refusing to let that potentiality find its way, all kinds of troubles and difficulties and pain and sorrow inevitably comes to us because we draw it upon ourselves. By refusing to be gods, the devils of the world have their fill of us. Now, I want to tell you something which might be very interesting. Aristotle taught that justice is the practice of virtue towards others. Now, that is an extraordinary thing to have said, isn't it? Aristotle said that. You'll find it in his great work on ethics, the Nicomachean Ethics, in Book 5, Chapter 2. Took me a long time ferreting out the exact reference. That's what Aristotle said. Now, Plato, in his Republic, put it in different terms. Justice is the having and doing what is one's own. It's in the Republic, section 433. Justice is the having and doing what is one's own. Now, it sounds rather flat and disappointing. Coming from Plato, we would expect some sort of transcendental, earth-shaking revelation. But Plato develops this and shows that each man, that he means that each man shall receive the equivalent of what he produces or gives, and shall perform the function for which he is best fit. A just man, therefore, is a man in his right place, doing his best, giving to society the full equivalent of what society gives him. Justice is, as in the Greek, a taxis and taxis kai kosmos, that is, an order and an effective harmony of the whole. That is why where the value of the word cosmos comes in. It's an order, complete and perfect order. You know how Krishnamurti time and again talks of order, and what he means by order is something quite different, quite profounder really, not so different, but quite profounder than what the world means by the word order. Now, note this. A just man is a man in his right place, doing his best, giving to society the full equivalent. Well, what I would like to see not there is the word equivalent. I would say giving the fullness of himself without measurement, as the Buddha says, immeasurably. You see, the fullness of himself in response to what society gives him. Otherwise, there is a certain element of exchange, barter, about it. Of course, I had read Plato when I was 10. And I hadn't read the whole of the Republic. But the similar ideas come in the other dialogues of which I was very fond. The Apology, of course, the Crito, the Phaedo, and the Protagoras. Those four dialogues meant an enormous amount to me. And those made me feel that if anybody does anything for me or gives something to me, I mustn't sort of measure out a due reward. But I must give the best of myself and always trust the other to give the best of himself. That's why during all the years that I taught music pupils, whilst there was a sort of a supposed set fee, I never bothered about that. I always trusted them to give the best that they were capable of giving, and I always gave the best of myself without measuring out what I was doing. And I think it is something which meant a great deal to the pupils. Now let us consider this other idea about the action and reaction being equal and opposite. This is Newton's third law, of course, is applicable and true in mechanics. But it is manifestly absurd where the understanding of karma is concerned, especially in the Buddhist context. For this reason, particularly, the Buddha taught that everything continuously changes. Supposing something is done now, that action, of course, apparently, is just precisely that action and nothing else. But there is a subtle going on of that action, invisibly, intangibly to us. You see? It goes on and on. It is changing all the time. How are you going to measure out what the action was? How are you going to present something which is equal and opposite? Now, if it is opposite, then it will be opposite in every respect. It may be opposite, would necessarily be opposite in physical terms, but would it be in qualitative terms? Because if I did some good action, then the equal and opposite reaction should give me some evil. You see why I said what I said at the beginning of our meeting, that these ideas which we have, the conditioning in our minds through our study and upbringing and all the rest of it, is a terrible factor, really. We get all sorts of queer ideas. The Buddha clearly taught that nothing remains changeless. If the result of action in volitions, speech, act is equal and opposite, then if we could have an equal reaction, there would be a static equilibrium. And that means no growth, no progress at all. It would be a static equilibrium. It would be like a stagnant pond. The water of the pond exerts a pressure on the surrounding land which holds it, the surrounding earth which holds it, and the two pressures are equal and opposite. Now that is all right. We can leave it at that. But you see, it's a stagnant pond. There is nothing. There's no growth. There is no fruition involved in it. There is no life involved in it, really. Again, clearly, rigid causation must be ruled out. So we may see that in the universal flux of the ceaseless becoming process, what appears as cause or a set of causes at any one instant becomes, that is, changes into effect or effects the next instant, which in turn is a cause of the next change, etc., and so on, ad infinitum. There is this perpetual living process. It's the livingness of the process of karma which people miss out in their thinking. They think of it in dead terms. 20 shillings for a pound note. But 20 shillings for a pound note, well, you are no foreigner. Each person still has a pound. You might say, yes, it's perhaps it was more convenient for this person to have it in shillings. Yes, that may be the case, but you see what I am getting at. Remember, no one person or thing or energy is the sole exclusive agent of any action or event. So it is perfectly ridiculous to say, you did this, you are responsible for it. Other people have, he may have consulted other people may have put the idea into him, his circumstances may have played their part, a change in the law or the situation. All these influences at play resulted in that particular action. So you see, you can't say that he is solely responsible. Not a single one of us is solely responsible for any particular thought or feeling or word or action in our lives. We are all interwoven. We are all bound up. We are all our brother's keepers, whether we would like to acknowledge it or not. It's impossible to avoid it. Now, that doesn't mean we should interfere with our brother's affairs and make a nuisance of ourselves. That's what too many people do. It is impossible, therefore, to allocate karma to any separate person or force at play. To any separate person or force. All we can say is that the karmic process is constantly proceeding according to law. And by that, by law is meant whatever is or occurs at any point instant is the resultant of all the forces at play. You know how in that book, The Mysterious Universe, Sir James Jeans pointed out that the slightest movement here affects the furthest star in the cosmos. You see? I mean, that is very true. I mean, if scientists have come to see that through purely through physical material research, it behoves us to have considerable intelligence in interpreting karma properly. If we can perceive the true nature, more or less, of karma, we can direct the course of our life intelligently and humanly. We can cease to be producers of evil and swim contrary to the stream of suffering engulfing all that lives.